and less are you able to actually go to a cinema and sit and have the cinematic experience, which is so rewarding, and which is community. A cinema is community. The cinema is a collective experience with other people. And that's cinema to me.
Hello, and thank you for joining us for the Woodstock Film Festival Let's Talk Film podcast. I'm your host, Katie Mejia. Established in 2000, the Woodstock Film Festival is a not-for-profit 501c3 organization that nurtures and supports emerging and established filmmakers, sharing their creative voices through an annual festival and year-round programming to promote culture, diversity, community, educational opportunities, and economic growth. Today, I am joined by board member representing New York Women in Film and Television, producer Kim Jackson. Welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Katie.
You presented the New York Women in Film and Television Outstanding Filmmaker Award. Can you tell us more about that and the Woodstock Film Festival partnership?
Yes, well, New York Women in Film has, through the years, participated with the Woodstock Film Festival in lots of meaningful ways. Since I came on the board, I've had the fortunate opportunity to attend on behalf of New York Women in Film and present the last couple of years now filmmaker awards. We do one award for documentary, and we do one award for narrative film to an outstanding film directed by a woman.
That's fantastic. So can you tell me a little bit more about the organization itself, about New York Women in Film and Television, and how you got involved in it?
Sure. Well, New York Women in Film and Television was founded in the 70s, so we're about 40 years old or more. New York Women in Film supports women in entertainment, in media and television. We really have a mission to promote with all sorts of different companies in our industry, diversity and equity for women in the workplace. It's one of the most important things that we're doing. And the executive team that we have is just absolutely incredible. They work tirelessly. We work with all different sorts of organizations throughout the year. We have an annual gala called the Muse Awards, which we just completed in March. It was at Cipriani. It was a really, really fabulous award. We give away 9 awards to outstanding women. I highly recommend this in the future. We also have several summits. We have one coming up this summer. We're really focused on educating women and promoting and elevating women in the workplace in media and television and the arts.
Fantastic. So recently I wrote a little blog post on Woodstock Film Festival, so you can go check that out. It was called 5 Films to Watch for Women's History Month, and I just did a little bit of research. In 2022, female characters comprised 33% of protagonists, up 2 percentage points from 31% in 2021, and 38% of major characters, up 3 percentage points from 35% in 2021. Females accounted for 37% of all speaking characters, up 3 percentage points from 34% in 2021. 80% of films featured more male than female characters. And I was just curious how you feel and how you think equity and equality for women is today.
Well, we certainly have work to do, don't we? Which is why organizations such as NYWIF, exist, unfortunately. It would be great if we didn't have to have this, but this has been the plight of women for many, many, many centuries. I mean, we are the largest minority on the planet. I think we've seen some changes, some positive changes in the last bunch of years, but we certainly have more work to do. I also wanted to mention that in your last question regarding, NYWIF and what we do, we have incredible programming every day, every month for education purposes for women. So, when you are a member, you have access to so many amazing types of support and education. Getting back to, this question about how I feel about it. I mean, it's why I joined the board. It's why I, advocate for women. I mean, I went to an all women's college. I went to Simmons College. And so, I think that there's power in numbers. Women coming together to help support other women has always been a meaningful endeavor for me. All industries are powered by men. It's just how things have been. I do see some shifts happening, but we certainly have a lot more work to do.
little by little, little by little, right? As they say,
little by little, that's
in Spanish. They say poco a poco. It's like just incrementally, you know, every year it's a couple more percentage points. But, you know, even with animated films, I follow Gina Davis and her work. And it was just, I believe it was in that documentary that came out in 2018 that she was a part of. It was something that really blew my mind about animated films, that it's mostly male characters and mostly male voiceover. And I just wouldn't have thought that, because of course I have daughters and I'm always watching more of the female center Moana type films. But it's funny because you do see a lot more, you would think, but it, ultimately as a whole, they're smaller percentage opportunities for women. So organizations like New York Women in Film and Television and others are super crucial. You guys have a membership promotion that you're running right now. You can tell us a little bit more about that.
Oh, well, I mean, we always do once a year, sometimes, you know, other times throughout the year, there's opportunities to join and get, you know, the initiation fee waived and things like that. So this is typically heading into summer, a good time to join. There's going to be a summit, this workforce summit that's going to be happening this summer. There's just so many incredible opportunities. I mean, I've been aware of women in film since, you know, I started working in the industry. And when I first started, I was in Boston because I went to college there, and there was a chapter of women in film there. And I, you know, joined that organization. And then when I moved to New York, of course, I got involved with New York Women in Film as a member. And in the last bunch of years, I've certainly seen an increase in the amount of benefits. A lot of our members are also in the PGA or the WGA, or, you know, or actors, or, you know, in SAG. So, you know, we certainly help support, you know, other organizations and partner with other organizations as well. You know, I'm mentoring a filmmaker right now who did apply for the fiscal sponsorship. And that was a really great thing for her, because it really helped her raise her funds. And she was pretty successful about that in a short period of time.
Yeah, fundraising isn't the fun part of filmmaking at all. You know, I've done like a bunch of Kickstarters and whatever, and I'm still traumatized from that. But there are other ways than doing it that way. So I need to look into that myself. Cool. So I wanted to quickly get into some of the other things that were really interesting, that are interesting to you and interesting to me as well. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that you talked about is that technology is of special interest to you, because you obviously see it, and most people hopefully, you know, are seeing it as a way that it can serve and advance humanity. And, you know, and then we have Enter 2001 Space Odyssey, you know, we've got the whole like AI thing, right? Here we are. It's finally arrived, even though it's been a part of what we've been doing for a while. But it's been kind of in the shadows. You know, I myself was kind of using it to do little things here and there, like copywriting and, you know, coming up. I was trying to come up with a log line for like my documentary. I was like, let me see what this comes up. And it was terrible. It didn't help me at all in that way. But I mean, it's helping other people. And one way it did help was we have all this, like these images, these archival images from like the 1800s. And so they were super pixelated, and there's software that'll like repeat and make the image more high resolution and things like that. So what is your feeling about the direction we're going with artificial intelligence in art, like in filmmaking, in the creative art?
Well, I think it's a controversial subject, you know, and there's always a double-edged sword with technology, because human beings are behind it. And as we look at our world, we see that there's good actors and there's bad actors. And I don't mean people who are, you know, in the craft of, you know, getting up on stage. I mean, you know, people either act in a good way or a bad way. And I think that with AI, there's some certainly positive opportunities for use cases for AI. I mean, it exists right now. We use it. I mean, it's happening. It's using us all the time. Algorithms that we see on all the social media platforms, that's all done by AI. It's coming in a much more robust way. We're not going to be able to stop it. It's going to happen. It does need to be regulated. I think that just like the internet, it needs to be regulated. I feel like America will be on board with that. Other countries will be on board with that. It will be interesting to see if some of the other countries that, you know, like China, for example, I'm not, you know, like with what they're doing with TikTok and stuff like that. It'll be interesting to see how they treat AI. You know, I think that it doesn't replace human beings when it comes to creativity. You know, I know there's a lot of conversation, especially with the WGA strike that's happening right now, and AI is such a big, you know, conversation. I just don't see how it could be of quality. You know, I mean, I just don't see how the writing can be of quality. And I don't see how that writing wouldn't ultimately be edited by a human being anyway. You know, let's just say AI spits out a, you know, 96 page script. It's going to have to be read by human beings. It's going to have to be, you know, cast by human beings. It's going to have to be directed by human beings. So I just don't see, you know, it being something that's going to take over for writers necessarily.
Yeah. I mean, that, like I said, the way I used it is more of like a personal assistant to suggest things. None of the actual like log line or anything it came up with was remote. It was very machine-like. And it's like, my film is actually more about nature too. So it was kind of funny. It was like, wow, this really doesn't work. And it was more just like a test. I just wanted to try out ChatGPT and see like, what is this thing doing? But, you know, they did fix some images in the film. And so I see the use of it, but more not necessarily creativity, you know, as far as taking over any kind of creative job. I mean, there's just absolutely no way. It's too machine-like. It's like a personal assistant. So I also agree with you in that way. I don't think that that's where it's at. And I think there's going to be a lot of confusion around it. But one thing I do think is interesting is that, you know, we don't have a code of ethics, you know, as far as like, you know, and a lot of people will say that corporate America pretty much runs the world. And then you have China, like you said, which they're the Communist Party runs China and TikTok and all these things. Right. And there's no code of ethics. I mean, the ancient Chinese people had incredible code of ethics. I mean, it's amazing what the ancients had in terms of like code of ethics. It was very important to sort of follow these things. It was about our cultures. Indigenous Native Americans have amazing code of ethics that now we all study and try to learn from their spiritual teachings. But today we don't have that. So because there's a lack of code of ethics, anything could happen. And where we're at as creative people is that if it's becoming a problem, let's create a code of ethics that we have to follow. So that it, you know, and like you said, that's regulations from the government, but the government is mostly, you know, ran by corporations and they're for profit.
It's the United Corporation of America. That's what it is.
100%. So you know, where is that code of ethics going to come from? Is there someone like you who studies this and who wants to really, you know, make sure that it's regulated in the correct way? Is there going to be a person that can do that? And that's kind of where I'm at with it, you know, as far as government goes. Do you think that that might be one of the ways there's a person appointed to sort of creating this code of ethics or some way so that we can manage where it kind of goes wrong?
Well, I think that that's inevitable, just like they did with the internet. I mean, in the 90s, 80s, 90s, I mean, there was no such thing as the internet. And you know, a lot of people listening who were born in, you know, after that had no idea what life was like before that. But, you know, there's funny clips that you'll see of TV, of newscasters and all kinds of people going, what is this now? Internet? Oh, it'll never last. And it's like, it's our life. You and I are talking right now live and I'm in my place and you're in your place and we're doing this because of the internet, you know? And so to try to explain, you know, to somebody the future of all of this, I think that right now there are regulations that already exist when it comes to, and I think social media is really now driving that home with authorities, with, you know, with federal government and other governments and other countries that, you know, regulation is going to be needed. And I'm sure there'll be some types of committees with experts, like, you know, who knows, and he's controversial, but, you know, the Elon Musks of the world. You know, for better or for worse, but these are the tech leaders, you know, the tech leaders are going to probably be involved in some level, advising or whatever. But I think that, you know, the history of computer science is something that everybody should do themselves a favor and check out, you know, and just sort of look at that timeline. We're not peaked yet. We haven't peaked in terms of, you know, computer science and its impacts and its abilities on human beings and collective consciousness. There was a really interesting book written in the 70s by Alvin Toffler called Future Shock. And essentially, you know, he talks about in this book the impacts to collective consciousness that computer and technology is going to have, and that it's going to at some point move faster than the human brain can actually comprehend. And that at some point, you know, a lot of psychoses and other types of, you know, mental breakdowns for human beings are likely. And I think we're starting to see that. I think we're starting to already see that. And I don't think it's going to necessarily get any better until people start to really understand that, limiting their time, getting outside, touching grass, you know, like using this as a tool versus it using you like a tool, which I think for most people it is. And the pandemic didn't help because it forced us inside. It forced us, the only way we could connect with each other was to be in front of a screen and to be, you know, sharing information via social media or, you know, other technology devices. And I just think that didn't help things, you know, on some level. And then, you know, there's the people who feel like technology is a beautiful, awesome, amazing thing to help advance human beings. And I do on some level believe that too. I think blockchain technology is extremely exciting. I think that the benefits of blockchain technology, if governments will allow it, which they don't understand it and they're very afraid of it because it's something that they don't have the probably, you know, resources to actually, you know, seriously look into the benefits of it and how it can benefit, you know, a lot of systems that are broken in our world, voting being one of them. With blockchain technology, it is something that allows for complete transparency of every transaction. And I think, you know, some powers to be just don't want that. So, you know, there are technologies that I believe are extremely exciting, but also, it is a controversial topic for me these days, and it's a personal question I have for myself, which is, you know, here I am, a producer who makes films that people watch on a screen, and hopefully it's a big screen, but it's less and less a big screen. It's usually a small screen now, because if things go straight to video and things don't get a theatrical that much anymore. And I'm contributing on some level to storytelling on a screen, and I'm promoting people to stop and look at a screen. And, you know, from an ethical perspective right now, I'm questioning this for myself. Like, how beneficial is this? It's not a popular question for people in our industry because people are like, I want to tell a story. I want to make a movie. And I've been making movies for 20 years and I do enjoy what we offer. However, less and less are you able to actually go to a cinema and sit and have the cinematic experience, which is so rewarding, and which is community. A cinema is community. The cinema is a collective experience with other people. And that's cinema to me, you know.
That's one of my favorite parts of the Woodstock Film Festival, of these little showings or these little screens we get together and there's like 50 people, who cares, like 100 people. And we're in an old school cinema, and especially if it's outdoors, that's even better, you know, in the summer. But it's so true. I mean, you know, go ahead with that, but I just had to jump in. It really is a challenge, you know. And plus the editors that are making the film, they're on the computer all day. I mean this is, editing is so hard, and you're just on, and you know, you've got to take breaks and go outside, like you said, and just put your feet in the grass to get the electromagnetics to shock you back into, because you can't get that energy just by sitting on a computer all day.
Yes. And this is why festivals like the Woodstock Film Festival, bringing community together, have a collective experience, have an emotional collective experience, and then talk to the filmmakers about it meaningfully. And the people who participated, the actors and, you know, the sound people and the editor and everyone, you know, then you're having a real artistic conversation. And, you know, that's a lot different, and I think a much more important experience than going to whatever streamer app and watching a film, you know, in front of your television and being distracted with your phone and five other things that are going on. You know, that to me is content. And I don't care for that word. You know, it's like a bad word to me. But that word to me is like consuming. You're consuming, just like I'm consuming anything else. You know, it's a consumer product versus having a film in a theater space where there's community and conversation having, which is why film festivals are so incredibly important, and why the community at large should get out and, you know, enjoy these art form, this art form, because it, you know, it's, it can be, and it is.
And I mean, that leads me to my next question, because your, one of your films is actually touches on that, which is, I think if you can't get the community connection, which you should have 100%, and I believe people are getting together, maybe on small levels, to see films, there's that storytelling piece in there to remind us to maintain that connection. And it makes me think of the last film you just were working on, Down with the King, a film that is basically about a rapper who's like somebody who is living his whole life in an urban environment, leaves the city and goes to the Berkshires to kind of just get peace of mind, to kind of mentally clear himself so that he can be creative. Can you tell us a little bit more about that film and how you got involved in the story itself? Because I think it's a powerful message.
Well, yeah, I mean, I believe we were pitched at Film Independent Week. You know, they have those weeks just like the Gotham does, you know. And so we were aware of the story and the filmmaker who had a really interesting film. His name is Diego Ungaro. He had an interesting film at Sundance several years before called Bob in the Trees. And he's has a really beautiful aesthetic. And the pandemic hit. And we were like, what are we going to do? We're just sitting here. And my husband remembered, who's my producing partner, Zach, he remembered that story. One of our other producing partners on board said, you know, it's doable in terms of the scope of the script and the story. And, you know, let's see what they got going on. Let's see if they're around. Let's see where they are in the pandemic. And it just sort of made sense. You know, we didn't want to be idle, and we wanted to, you know, everybody was shut in. And so the theme of this is really mental health, you know, and self care of your own mental health. And it just made sense. It all sort of, you know, came together. They had already had the locations that they wanted to shoot, you know, kind of scouted out, and people had already decided that they would be on board once everything came together. So we shot it, you know, a la COVID rules. And it's a really small, you know, crew and remote locations in the woods. And
in the Berkshires, right? At a farm.
At a gorgeous, yeah, beautiful farm. And so then edited fairly quickly and submitted to Cannes and was accepted to Cannes Seed. And it did very well. And then Sony came in and said they'd buy it, which was fantastic. A.O. Scott of New York Times put it in his critic's pick several times. And we were honored that he loved it so much. And around the Oscars, he actually added it to his list of films that should receive an Oscar nomination but won't.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah.
We were like, oh, thank you. So, you know, he really
from Freddie Gibbs. It. I mean, he's, I guess, yeah. That was part of, he was, yes. He was the starring.
Exactly. Yeah. He appreciated it. We appreciated that. He appreciated it because it really didn't get a lot of US festival love, but it had, you know, it was in Cannes and then we got distribution, which is a beautiful thing. These days it's very rare. It's very hard to get distribution. So we were very grateful. You know, we submitted to awards season. So all of the different awards, but you know,
well, I highly recommend it. Go see it. Where can we see it? You're going to tell me some streaming platform.
Oh, it's everywhere.
It's everywhere. Great. The film is starring Freddie Gibbs, Down with the King. It's about a rapper that goes to the Berkshires and it's a really interesting about mental health, you said. So I think it ties in perfectly with what we were kind of talking about.
Yeah, that's all the overall theme.
I mean, yeah. I think it's interesting that, you know, we're all, our work is always sort of connected to the greater reality that we're living in. And, you know, at the time, I can only imagine artists trying to create anything with the lockdown. It was really difficult. So you're a producer, and you, in your bio, you say producers begin food chains which feed all life. Can you elaborate a little bit more on that quote? Because I love that.
Thank you. Well, that's when you look at plant life, you know, and they call it a producer. And then if you apply that to just about making anything in life, you know, happen. When I read that, it had to do with nature, and it really just resonated to me regarding what I do as a producer. And it's one of those jobs where when you're not in the industry, people always go, what do you do? Like, what does a producer do? And you're like, pretty much everything. You know, it's like, and we get the least amount of recognition and love. You know, no one wants to talk to us. So thank you for wanting to talk to me today. Everyone wants the actors and the director and, you know, the creative set. But yeah, so listen, I think producers are the ones, it's like we're the fire underneath of it all, you know, making it happen, you know, making the engine run and making sure it gets there on time and making sure it, you know, everybody is taken care of and has all the things that they need. And, you know, it's an interesting job. It's never the same twice. At least it hasn't been for me. Every single time I produce something, it's totally, you know, different. I learned something different about the industry. I learned something different about myself, more importantly. And, you know, it's a very dynamic, interesting job to have because it, you know, you certainly don't have to worry about monotony. You know, it's always going to be different. And, so it just resonated with me when I read that as it related to nature. And I was like, yeah, that's pretty much the truth. And I studied environmental science. So I'm a science nerd and then of course went into filmmaking pretty much right after college. So I never really worked in my field, but I have that sensibility and I have that interest in how things work and how nature works. And you know, that it's an interesting juxtaposition because we are, I mean, I think filmmaking has become so tech heavy, you know, it's such a technical job now. I mean, we rely on technology so much. And I remember when streaming came, I remember when I used to get my Netflix DVDs in the mail and I loved them. I loved getting my little DVDs with like a little present and you get them. You're like, oh yeah, I ordered that. I put it on my list and oh yeah, here it is. And I remember when streaming came and I'm like, I'm not doing that. I am not streaming a movie on my computer. You're not getting me to sign up. I am not doing that. I am getting my DVDs. And I was probably one of the last people to get the DVDs because I just didn't want to do it. I didn't even have cable TV in my house for a really long time living here in New York. And my friends in the industry would come over and they'd be like, you don't have cable? I'd be like, no, I have like rabbit ears and I get a couple channels if I need the news, but I just pretty much watch movies and that's it on my DVDs, you know, like, or go to the movies or go to the theater, you know? And they were like, but you're in the entertainment industry. Shouldn't you have cable? And I was like, probably, but I don't. I don't watch the news. I don't do any of that stuff. But I digress. And the point I'm making is like, it's very tech heavy. So for me to be able to find the connection and bring, you know, nature and, you know, natural processes and the human experience into what we do, I think we need it more than ever right now, especially coming out of this pandemic, like I mentioned, and that we were forced to just stare at screens. You know, I'm looking for that connection myself. And I think, you know, it'd be good to hear if others are too.
Yeah, 100%. I think that we are realizing, you know, what I like to say is, you know, nature's the cure. Everything that we are and who we, you know, represent is, you know, is nature. And so the more that we can get closer to that, and as a filmmaker, the more, you know, of that kind of thematic messaging can be in your film, I think that that's where we can make that balance. I also feel in the same way, you know, I lost a lot of steam in some of the stuff I was working on too. And it was a lot of what you're talking about. It's like, I would rather be gardening outside. I'd rather be growing food. And I really don't want to be inside editing, you know, or I don't want to mess with my camera. It's changed 100 times. Now, you know, the Blackmagic camera that I have is no good. We got to get a new one. I mean, it's just this constant, like I'm running to try to keep up with everything. And, you know, and even with the streaming platforms, it's like, okay, now there's no HBO. Now it's Max. Okay. Now it's not, you know, now it's not Showtime anymore. It's Paramount Plus. Like, what are we doing? You know, I mean, it's at times it just seems really disheartening and not inspiring. And so that's why having this conversation with you, and I hope that our audience gets inspired too, mm-hmm. and continues to listen to this podcast, because what you're talking about is so important. And I'm so glad we're having this conversation. But we can continue doing what we're doing. We just got to have balance and, you know, come out to these events and have these emotional responses to these stories that need to be told. And so we're going to wrap this up, and we usually do that by asking a question that involves, why is independent filmmaking important to you?
because of conversations like this with people like you and film festivals like Woodstock Film Festival, it's one of the things that inspires me to do it is the people, you know, and the stories and the different diverse stories that we see coming out.
Beautiful. I mean, that's really what it's all about. It's just about, it's about the stories. And so thank you for sharing your story with us. You know, I hope you continue to do that, and more power to you.
And you too. And everybody listening.
Everybody listening, you know, yeah. Filmmaking is tough. I know you're watching this because you are probably one. You know, highly recommend becoming a member of New York Women Film and Television. Come out to festivals, come out to events where you're having real emotional connections with folks. And, you know, the art form will continue in whatever way it's going to continue.
I agree. It will continue. What caliber will be it. But I do think that more people are interested in those human connections. And, you know, the more we can promote that and more we can, you know, encourage people to, you know, to come out and hear how the bread is baked, so to speak, the better for all of us. So I'm looking forward to the festival this year.
We also have some deadlines coming up, so be sure to submit your film. Don't forget to please subscribe to our YouTube channel and the like button and all that good stuff. Follow us so we can keep this going. And we're going to see you next time in person at an event, right?
Sounds great. Thanks, Katie.
Thank you so much. Take care.